Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
Well, you know, I remember coming up on train to London, and I thought, I know all these bloody trees, you know, and I've never seen any of them before, which tells you something about the education system of colonials.
London is the place for me. London, this lovely city. You can go to France or America, India, Asia or Australia, but you must come back to London City.
So it's a long time ago. That means I'm not a post-colonial subject, which is the kind of current phrase. I'm a colonial. You know, I was formed in my childhood, etc. I came as a colonial. I came bearing a British passport, you know, British subject, etc. It's only after that I had to apply for one or permission to stay.
That was the late Stuart Hall speaking about arriving in England for the first time on the BBC radio programme Thinking Aloud with Laurie Taylor in 2011. Welcome to Stuart Hall in Conversations. I'm Ben Carrington. Stuart Hall was born in Jamaica on February the 3rd, 1932. Thus, he was born a colonial subject, a child of empire. It would be another 3 decades before Jamaica would gain its independence from Britain. In 1951, and still a teenager, Hall left the Caribbean and travelled to Oxford University to study as a Rhodes Scholar. It was this outsider perspective as a colonial subject, travelling back to the metropole, legally a British subject but somehow not fully British, in but not of British culture, that perhaps gives Hall his unique insights into the importance of culture in shaping national identities, and the ways in which all identities were as much a product of historical circumstance and politics as they are personal choice and biography. Les Back is a professor of sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London. I spoke with him in the summer of 2016 about Stuart Hall's background in colonial Jamaica and how that experience shaped Hall's development as an intellectual.
Stuart comes from Jamaica. He comes out of a colonial culture in which the politics of shade are very brutally imposed, the sort of shadow of colonial power.
And when we say the politics of shade, what
well, so you know, in the and as an effect of the British Empire, you know, what emerged in particularly in Jamaica was a kind of hierarchy, which was a hierarchy of shade, of shadism almost. You know, so the lighter those colonial subjects were, the higher they were on this hierarchy of shade. And in his own family, I think he was darker than some of his relatives and so on. He didn't talk about it when we met, but he talked about it subsequently, how much that had torn his family apart, actually. So he'd come from this kind of context to Oxford, you know, the high table of the English class system, right? He's both, you know, completely committed to the life of the mind, fascinated with English literature, but, you know, in place and out of place at Oxford, comes to London. He starts making a living close to where we're standing here in South London, in a secondary modern school, one of those working class schools, teaching kids, you know, geography. Being taught by Stuart Hall geography in the late 1950s. Anyway, so that's his kind of formation, and he makes a life here, really, and he in a sense makes a kind of an agenda for his own thinking here, initially through his engagement with the New Left and the new politics and understandings of division and class here, and then as an extension, an understanding of the black experience in London and in Britain, not in the Caribbean, in Britain. So, you know, in many respects, he was the greatest interpreter of English life or British life that lived in my lifetime. Yet he was not, he always felt, that's partly where he was both at home here an incredible interpreter of English culture and English life and the politics of post-colonial London particularly. At the same time, he never felt at home within it. So that's that at home, not at home.
Mm. Yeah.
And it was this sense of being at home, but not at home, the sense of being somehow estranged, a kind of intellectual exile, that gave Hall a unique perspective into British culture and especially into the rhythms and mores of English life. Remarkably, by the time he reaches his 40s, Hall is arguably the leading political commentator on British culture and politics. According to Back, Stuart Hall had an incredible capacity to capture in a seemingly banal, everyday object, deeper historical meanings, to show through sophisticated analysis the ways in which narratives of British history could only be truly understood when they were placed in a wider context that included the transnational flows that shaped and made the British Empire.
So, you know, he tries to undermine the idea of small island Englishness or Britishness. My God, that's made a comeback lately. Through saying, well, you know, let's take the symbol of the cup of tea. Where does the sweet traces of sugar that rots the young people of England's teeth come from? It doesn't come from the green fields of Surrey. You know, it comes from the plantation societies in the Caribbean. Where does the tea come from? You know, they aren't growing it in Essex. You know, so do you see what I mean? He had that capacity to take something small and suddenly think, wow.
What Hall uncovered through his close look at the interconnectivity of culture, objects, history and politics was much more than a one-dimensional analysis of the relationship between culture and power.
What he provided was a mode of really rigorously and critically thinking about how culture has political content, has layered meanings.
Imani Perry is a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, and one of America's leading commentators on the cultural politics of race, gender, and class.
I think that we sometimes can have a tendency to sort of focus on so closely on the particularities that we don't of an experience that we don't sort of step outside and think about the forces and structures that produce a set of experiences and a set of imperatives for people who are justice and inclusion and transformation. And so I think the reason Hall's work is so influential is that he demonstrates how you navigate between the particulars of a political moment, an economic moment, and thinking about sort of forces that are at play to produce that moment.
After completing his undergraduate degree, Hall decided not to return to Jamaica and instead stayed on at Oxford, where he started a PhD on the American-born British writer Henry James. However, it was a PhD Hall would never complete. In the mid to late 1950s, Hall became increasingly involved in politics and the new social movements of the age, such as the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. It is important to remember that this was a period of radical social and political change, as Britain lost control of its colonies due to the anti-colonial uprisings and nationalist independence movements of the 1950s and 60s. In a speech to the South African Parliament in 1960, the British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, famously referred to this as the wind of change blowing across the British Empire.
And the most striking of all the impressions that I have formed since I left London a month ago is of the strength of this African national consciousness. In different places, it takes different forms, but it is happening everywhere. The wind of change is blowing through this continent, and whether we like it or not, this growth of national consciousness is a political fact. And we must all accept it as a fact. And our national policies must take account of it.
At the same time as the wind of change dismantled Britain's imperial project, the centre of global geopolitical power moved from Britain and Western Europe to America. Simultaneously, following World War II, the Soviet Union emerged as a dominant force in world affairs, radically altering and, to some extent, threatening Britain's place in the global order. In 1956, Britain suffered political humiliation in Egypt, following a joint military operation with Israel and France, known as the Suez Crisis.
That Egypt has seized the internationally owned Suez Canal. His announcement touches.
Although the initial invasion was successful, the military operation rendered the canal largely useless, and the resulting international pressure forced the invading countries to withdraw. This marked the moment when, as the historian Tony Judd puts it, the illusions of empire died.
Brings a three-power meeting in London to discuss the biggest threat this year has posed to world peace.
With these historic changes to the fabric of Western societies and Britain's decline as a major global force, Hall, along with other significant British intellectuals, such as the historians E.P. Thompson and Perry Anderson, and the literary theorist Raymond Williams, attempted to rethink the basis for democratic socialism outside of the twin models offered by orthodox Marxism and Stalinism on the one hand, and the traditional pro-capitalist social democratic parties, such as the Labour Party, on the other. Hence, what came to be called the New Left. Remarkably, while still in his late 20s, a relatively unknown Stuart Hall became the founding editor of the New Left Review, a key journal of the British New Left that still plays a prominent role in theorising politics and social change today. In what would become a defining feature of his work, Hall challenged the left to understand the importance of culture to left-wing politics and how culture itself, especially the increasingly globalised and Americanised arena of popular culture, was the site of and for politics. In 1960, the first edition of New Left Review was published. In his introductory editorial, Hall says the following. The purpose of discussing the cinema or teenage culture in New Left Review is not to show that, in some modish way, we are keeping up with the times. These are directly relevant to the imaginative resistances of people who have to live within capitalism, the growing points of social discontent, the projections of deeply felt needs. Our experience of life today is so extraordinarily fragmented. The task of socialism is to meet people where they are touched, bitten, moved, frustrated, nauseated, to develop discontent and, at the same time, to give the socialist movement some direct sense of the times and ways in which we live. I asked Adam Elliott Cooper, a teaching fellow in sociology at Warwick University, about the emergence of the New Left Review. We met above a pub around the corner from the Stuart Hall Library in East London in the summer of 2016.
So the New Left Review, I guess, kind of came out in this time of the rise of what we call the New Left, and this was where a period in which many people became disillusioned with the ideals of what was the Soviet Union at the time, that had promised this kind of socialism, this equality, this workers' state, when in fact it descended into tyranny, it descended into forms of imperialism in parts of Eastern Europe, and people began to rethink what the left means outside of the kind of the power of the Soviet Union, and looking to other parts of the world, looking to trade unions in other parts of Europe, looking to social movements and decolonial movements in parts of Africa, Asia and Latin America, looking to the radical movements led by African Americans and women and the environmentalists in the United States, looking to these different kind of formations that didn't rely upon the state and didn't rely upon the centralized government of the Soviet Union, but instead relied upon ordinary people and their organizations.
4 years after the first issue of the New Left Review was published, Hall co-authored a book entitled The Popular Arts. That same year, 1964, Hall went to Birmingham University, where he joined the writer and academic Richard Hoggart, who had recently founded the Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies. The CCCS, as it came to be known, sought to better understand the relationship between culture, politics, and everyday life. Unlike elitist claims that popular culture was inherently compromised and lacking in originality due to its relationship to commerce, for example, Theodore Durno's famous dismissals of jazz, researchers at the CCCS argued instead that popular culture needed to be taken more seriously and was better approached as a contested site where new identities were formed and creative consumption was possible. Scholars at the CCCS argued that the spectacular post-war youth subcultures, such as the countercultures of the hippies and the bold oppositional styles of punk, posed symbolic forms of resistance to established social norms and structures. Les Back.
You know, it's a wonderful story about the relationship between Stuart and Richard Hoggart. Richard Hoggart was responsible for bringing Stuart Hall to Birmingham, where they were so involved and important in developing the Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies, which the University of Birmingham was a bit ambivalent about, to be honest with you, and probably was ambivalent about it throughout its extraordinary life. But they were really the key figures which created a space for a kind of interdisciplinary intellectual environment where, you know, new issues around understanding the politics of class and of gender and of race and of post-coloniality became possible in this pretty conservative institution. So the fact that at Goldsmiths here we have Hoggart on one side of the green and Stuart on the other is kind of fitting, I think. In fact, you know, after Stuart passed away, Dick Hebditch came here to speak, who wrote the very famous book, Subculture, the Meaning of Style. And I remember walking around the square with Dick, and he said it's kind of fitting in a way that Stuart and Richard should be on different sides of this divide, connected, not exactly under one roof, but in the same place. And I think he's right about that.
In 1968, Hall became the acting director of the centre and its sole director in 1972, when Hoggart took a position as Assistant Director General of UNESCO. During his time at Birmingham, Hall worked with a number of graduate students on a series of groundbreaking studies, including books such as Resistance Through Rituals, Youth Subcultures in Post-War Britain, published in 1975, and Policing the Crisis, Mugging, the State and Law and Order, that came out in 1978. This work laid the intellectual foundation for what became known as cultural studies, a field of study that revolutionised how culture would be understood across the social sciences and humanities thereafter. Here's Hall describing the beginning of the CCCS during an interview with the writer and journalist Maya Jaggi in the 2009 documentary Personally Speaking.
But we had to give a name and a frame to this sort of work. What was this sort of work? I remember a discussion with Richard Hoggart about whether we should call it an institute or a centre for cultural studies. Okay? And I said, it can't be an institute because there's nothing institutionalised about it. You know, it hardly has a couple of pounds in the bank to buy some books. You know, it's housed in a tiny Quonset hut on the edge of the campus. You know, we occupied all the most peripheral buildings on the Birmingham campus for about 10 years. So it couldn't be an institute, but it was a centre, rallying point. We didn't have the conscious ambition to create a discipline. That was never our idea. But we had to give a name and a frame to this sort of work. What was this sort of work? Yeah? On the dimensions of power which are carried in culture rather than in the economy or in the state. And I thought that had to be what it was about. You know, it wasn't an orthodoxy, but we created an intellectual milieu, a sort of matrix, yeah, from which people who were doing individual studies could draw.
As a result of this critical intervention, the traditional social science and humanities disciplines were challenged and, to some extent, transformed as cultural studies scholars attempted to produce a more multidimensional approach to the study of culture and society. You're listening to Stuart Hall in Conversations. I'm your host, Ben Carrington. When we come back, we'll look at Hall's move from the CCCS to the Open University, his prescient analysis of the emergence of Margaret Thatcher and what became known as Thatcherism. And we examine why the book Police in the Crisis made such a meaningful contribution to how we understand policing, race and crime. This is Stuart Hall in Conversations. Stay with us. Welcome back to Stuart Hall in Conversations. I'm your host, Ben Carrington. Still ahead, we'll explore the influence Stuart Hall had, not just on other intellectuals and the academy, but on visual artists, political activists, writers, and journalists, as well as how some of the ideas and concepts he introduced in the 1970s continue to be relevant today. But first, Margaret Thatcher speaking to Granada TV in 1978.
People are really rather afraid that this country might be rather swamped by people with a different culture. And you know, the British character has done so much for democracy, for law, and done so much throughout the world, that if there's any fear that it might be swamped, people are going to react and be rather hostile to those coming in. So if you want good race relations, you've got to allay people's fears on numbers.
In 1979, Stuart Hall wrote an essay in the political magazine Marxism Today entitled The Great Moving Right Show that was later republished in Hall's 1988 book, The Hard Road to Renewal, Thatcherism and the Crisis of the Left. In that piece, Hall identifies Thatcherism as a major shift in British and indeed global politics. For Hall, Thatcherism was more than the normal electoral swing between left and right, but represented a fundamental change, a deep-seated structural shift in the nature of politics, in which free market ideologies would expand beyond the field of economics into all areas of our lives. From the very beginning, there was opposition to Thatcher. Even her first speech as Prime Minister outside of 10 Downing Street was given to the backdrop of protests.
May I just thank you very much.
How do you feel at this moment?
Very excited, very aware of the responsibilities. Her Majesty, the Queen, has asked me to form a new administration, and I have accepted.
Thatcher's arrival in government was met with popular resistance, both politically and culturally, as artists, filmmakers, writers and musicians produced anti-Thatcher books, films and songs.
This one's called Baggy Baggy Baggy!
Ow, ow, ow!
Hall foresaw how the state itself and the very idea of public goods was under attack and being replaced by an ideology that stressed market-based solutions to all social problems. Hall was one of the first intellectuals to recognise the new global order that we now refer to as neoliberalism. The key intervention that Hall made in his challenge to the left was not just the need to resist Thatcherism, but more importantly, the need to learn from Thatcherism, as he would put it in his book, The Hard Road to Renewal. For some on the orthodox hard left, this type of approach was considered a heresy. Simply denouncing Margaret Thatcher and her law and order, anti-union and nationalist agenda as fascist was seen to be a sufficient response. There was no need to seriously rethink leftist politics and positions. But Hall, from as far back as the early 1960s, was already attempting to grapple with these big historical shifts. Here's Stuart Hall in conversation with Laurie Taylor on the BBC programme Thinking Aloud.
I thought the period from the Depression and the war, which allowed the welfare state to come into existence, which allowed the Keynesian modifications in capitalist economics to actually take root, which enabled the founding of institutions like the NHS and so on, which expressed a view of the common good, not of the competitive, you know, murder them in their beds kind. I thought that was tremendously important interlude. I still think it is. You know, as somebody who was tempted in my youth by revolutionary theories, I very early felt this change in the welfare state is one of the most humane changes that have ever taken place. Okay, it was plain to me that the 70s, that Mrs. Thatcher coming to power, was the result of the disintegration of that welfare settlement, of its problems. The 70s is the moment when it's exploding all over the place. Trade unions, students, immorality in the island, etc., exploding. And she seized the moment, not just to take power or electoral victory from it, but to move the direction.
The failure of the left to adapt to these changing times allowed a figure like Margaret Thatcher to emerge. Part of the success of Thatcher, and Thatcherism, Hall argues, was to portray the Labour Party as the party of the status quo, of the establishment and the bureaucratic state, and to position herself as being on the side of the people, the common folks who just wanted to get ahead in life through hard work. In The Great Moving Right Show, Hall says, "Thus, in any polarisation along the fissure between state and people, it is Labour which can be represented as undividedly part of the power block, enmeshed in the state apparatus, riddled with bureaucracy, in short, as with the state." And Mrs. Thatcher, grasping the torch of freedom with one hand, as someone who is undividedly out there with the people. It is the Labour Party which is committed to things as they are, and Mrs. Thatcher, who means to tear up society by the roots and radically reconstruct it. This is the process by which, as they say, the radical right has become popular. It is in this context that Hall introduces a new concept to make sense of how Thatcherism is able to present itself as on the side of the people. Thus, he coins the term authoritarian populism. Here's the British Member of Parliament, Enoch Powell, discussing immigration and race in Britain in 1968, in a talk that became known as the Rivers of Blood speech.
In 15 or 20 years' time, the black man will have the whip hand over the white man. Well, I can already hear the chorus of execration. How dare I say such a horrible thing? How dare I stir up trouble and inflame feelings by repeating such a conversation? My answer is that I do not have the right not to do so.
Unless immigration from the Commonwealth countries is curtailed, Powell foresees America's race riots becoming a feature of British life. If it isn't, he warned, cities in the UK would be filled with blood due to what he believed would be the inevitable clashes between white and black Britons. But crucially, for a white nationalist like Powell, only white people could be unequivocally British. As Powell put it in his 1968 speech, a West Indian or an Asian does not, by being born in England, become an Englishman. In law, he becomes a United Kingdom citizen by birth. In fact, he is a West Indian or an Asian still. One of Hall's arguments in The Great Moving Right Show was that the anti-immigrant ideas espoused by Powell and others on the far right quickly became adopted in modified form by the mainstream Conservative Party. The threat supposedly posed by immigrant communities swamping British culture, as Margaret Thatcher infamously phrased it, needed to be dealt with by a strong law and order agenda. Thus, punitive forms of policing of black communities and the harsh prison sentences given out by the courts to those found guilty of breaking the law were portrayed as necessary to keep the rest of the nation safe. Punishing the poor and disciplining the blacks, in other words, became a way for Thatcher to generate the popular support she needed to advance her social and economic policies. Before The Great Moving Right Show, Hall introduced the concept of authoritarian populism in his 1978 co-authored book, Policing the Crisis. Les Back describes the importance of that book in the following way.
Even before he coins the phrase Thatcherism, he writes a very, very, very important book, which is so relevant to us now, with a group of postgraduate students at the Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies called Policing the Crisis. And what Policing the Crisis did so brilliantly was to show how a moral panic around a certain kind of racialised crime and how the idea of the mugger travels from the US and comes to Britain and becomes a kind of symbol, if you like, of that law and order society. He doesn't coin the phrase, he doesn't really develop the phrase, he coins it in Policing the Crisis, but he doesn't develop it later in terms of his analysis, until later in terms of his analysis of Thatcherism. But he shows how the work that form of racism is doing, not only to exclude those post-colonial migrants and their children, but what it's doing to actually manage the consensus and relations of dominance that are established within the society. So that is the vehicle through which the crisis is policed.
So he's connecting changes within the economic structures of society with the phenomenon of a particular type of crime, mugging, alongside questions of policing, alongside questions of changes to the nation state.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of things going on there. This seems to be like a multi-dimensional analysis.
It's an audacious, extraordinary, bold critique of how the culture is turning, you know, and a diagnosis. Now, you know, it isn't often... I mean, sociologists, he said this himself, sociologists really are able to predict anything with any kind of confidence or accuracy, I should say. But what they did, what the Policing the Crisis Collective did, was to predict the world that was coming, actually. You know, they picked up on that conjunctural shift, that tipping point in history, very early, and anticipated, you know, in large part, the history of our moment.
In an interview with the communications scholar Sat Jali, Hall reflected on the predictive power of Policing the Crisis.
Well, I would say Policing the Crisis is, you know, it's extremely important in understanding the whole arc of development, really. I mean, the whole arc of development from the post-war period. I would see that as composed of two basic eras, the sort of social democratic Keynesian welfare state moment, which is sort of the end of the war up to the 60s, begins to run into trouble in the 60s. By the 70s, its disintegration is palpable. It's coming apart at the seams. And a new paradigm comes into existence, which is neoliberalism. That has gone through several versions and variants and huge developments. I mean, from the early stages of the multinational corporation to, you know, global capitalist system, which is what we have now, is a huge historical development. But I think all of the period between the 70s and now is really part of that. So, almost casually, almost by chance, we hit on the moment of transition between two major conjunctures. Now, I also think that it gives me pleasure to say that though sociology, you know, thinks it's a predictive science, it doesn't predict anything very much, very well. Policing the Crisis predicts on the basis of the analysis it made. It said, this is not an electoral swing. It's not just a swing of the electoral pendulum. It's not just the usual ins and outs of politics. This is a major historical shift we're looking at, really deep and profound. The place will not be the same when this one gets going. So it's, you know, it's a historical moment. And the second thing that we said was, and if a certain kind of authoritarian populism is the way in which this crisis is resolved, it will have profound historical effects. And that's an anticipation of Thatcherism.
Another key contribution of Policing the Crisis was to reveal the role of the media in constructing a moral panic about mugging in Britain and, alongside that, portraying young black British men as the stereotypical mugger. This analysis is described by the sociologist Adam Elliot Cooper.
Stuart Hall's groundbreaking book, Policing the Crisis, looked at this pathology of the mugger in which people, particularly African Caribbean people, were identified as being involved in this so-called mugging epidemic. Not only did he kind of do the statistical work to show that it wasn't really an epidemic, it was something that was created by politicians and the press, but he also analysed the way in which British culture develops a pathology around black men in particular and their alleged propensity to criminalised behaviour. What we can kind of learn from Stuart Hall is that these very same cultural patterns of criminalising black people, but using this language that people associate with black people, which was the mugger in the 1970s and is now the gang member or the gangster today, continues. And it's necessary for us to recognise those kind of continuities if we were going to effectively address the way in which racism is articulated in Britain in the 21st century.
And it seems that there are strong parallels with some of the discussions taking place in the US right now
The discourse of the gang, or even the term thug, is one that is often used to kind of describe those involved, for example, in the Black Lives Matter social movements which have taken place across the US. So do you think there are parallels that can be drawn between Stuart Hall's work and what you've been looking at in the UK and current events in the US?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, the term mugger was actually borrowed from the United States in the first place in the 1970s. And so, unsurprisingly, we're seeing these same kind of patterns emerge today with the trope of the gangster and the gang member and wars over gang territory and all these kinds of discourses that are being transposed from the US context into the UK context. And I think that although we can over-egg the similarities between the UK and the US, it's clear that the kind of racist discourses that are being used in the United States are being borrowed and used against black people here in Britain in very comparable ways.
All's my life I has to fight. All's my life I hard times like yeah, bad trips like yeah. Nazareth got us, then we gon' be alright.
The American journalist Stephen Thresher writes for the UK-based newspaper The Guardian and is currently completing his PhD in American Studies at New York University. He spoke to me about how Hall's Police in a Crisis has been useful in helping him to better understand contemporary tensions around US policing, especially in relation to the repeated deaths of black Americans at the hands of police officers.
I was really interested in it because at that point I had just started covering the aftermath of the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And so I was interested in thinking about words like rioter and understanding when is rioter used, when is protester used, how does this become racialized. And so there's a way that Policing the Crisis reads as kind of old-fashioned, particularly if you're reading critical theory and things like that. In some ways it comes across as very technical. But as a journalist, it's an incredible, as an academic, but particularly as a journalist, it's an incredibly important book because it helps you understand how journalism is a mechanism through which race gets made and racial guilt is assigned. And so it was really interesting to see his studies breaking down for British newspapers, including The Guardian, of how different words were used and how the word mugging comes into the public lexicon. And I found it tremendously useful for trying to understand how race and racial guilt and racial innocence and the innocence of whiteness and the guilt of blackness were playing out in the media presently, even though this was happening decades after the book was written.
Does anybody hear us pray for Michael Brown or Freddie Gray? Peace is more than the absence of war.
I spoke with the writer and journalist Gary Young at The Guardian's offices in London in the summer of 2016. We discussed his take on Police in a Crisis, as well as Hall's distinctive approach to intellectual work.
I mean, certainly Police in a Crisis, this notion of, you know, if you have a massively unequal society and it's massively segregated and it's deindustrialized and uneducated, and your answer to all of those problems is not to educate, industrialize, employ, house, but to police, then that the central contradiction went out, you know, that there's no other way for this to work, really. And in that sense, even though Thatcher's Britain and Obama's America, one could argue, are different in many, many ways, in this specific way, they're really quite similar. And I mean, I do think with Stuart's work, generally speaking, so that one I do think translates quite as concretely, but for others it might be different. For me, what he contributes is a way of thinking. I mean, his particular thoughts and critiques are useful sometimes for that moment and sometimes beyond that moment, but it's the way of thinking that's the most useful.
As we have explored in this program, Hall's particular way of thinking as Young put it, influenced the New Left and helped to set the intellectual agenda more generally for the British left during the 1960s and 1970s. In the 1980s, the political magazine Marxism Today offered a critique and response to the rise and success of Thatcherism and Reaganomics, much as the New Left Review had done in relation to the collapse of the British Empire and the emergence of the Cold War decades earlier. Hall was a key figure in the debates of the New Left in the 1960s, and by the 1980s, Stuart Hall was widely recognised as one of Britain's leading public intellectuals. After a break, we'll discuss Hall's work as a black public intellectual and his lasting legacy as a widely read cultural theorist. This is Stuart Hall in Conversations. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Ben Carrington. You're listening to Stuart Hall in Conversations, a look at the life and legacy of the late cultural theorist Stuart Hall. Coming up, we'll explore Hall's work at the political magazine Marxism Today, his years as a professor of sociology at the Open University, and a look at the model of intellectualism that Hall provides still today. We continue our story at an independent bookstore in London, where Stuart Hall's personal library went on sale in the summer of 2016 at the request of his partner, the historian Catherine Hall. So I'm here in the back room of Houseman's bookstore, surrounded by the books of Stuart Hall, his private library, which has just gone on sale. Upstairs are fevered and feverish book buyers thumbing through a really wide range of different books. And I'm going to do a few interviews with people who are here to find out why they're here. Hi, could you tell me what your name is and why you're here today?
Hi, my name's Brendan McGeever. I'm from the University of London, Birkbeck College. And I'm here today to experience the Stuart Hall Library and to get to know it and to hopefully pick up some hidden gems among the many books.
Yeah. So it seems strange that people might be interested in going through the secondhand books of an academic. And upstairs there's a whole bunch of people, and I should say we're surrounded by hundreds of books, probably at least 300 or 400 books. More books are coming out,
and these are all priced, of course, at £1 to £3. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's also attracting people.
Yeah. So people might be here because there were cheap books. So, is it more than just the fact that this bookstore is selling some cheap secondhand
books? It's a lot more than that. I mean, you mentioned, you know, Stuart Hall was an academic, which of course is true, but he was much more than an academic. He was a public intellectual, who made a very serious contribution to developing the conversation in Britain and beyond, in fact, around the politics of race, culture, belonging, and his interest and contributions extended quite beyond that as well, into discussions around photography, culture, and politics above all. Politics. I mean, his role as a public intellectual extended into a whole range of avenues of British political and cultural life, and that's why I think so many people are here, because his library actually reflects this. I'm standing here looking at a book on Jews and modern capitalism, race and culture, Gramsci's Marxism, photography. I mean, his interests knew no bounds, and his contribution was really quite extensive. So I think that's why people are here as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite extraordinary just kind of flicking through the titles. There's every discipline is here, sociology,
every
history.
Every discipline. And these books, if you open them up, you'll see not only is his name on the title page, but also his annotations and his comments in the margins across a whole range of disciplines. I mean, this was a guy that read widely, that thought deeply, and made contributions across the political and cultural fields. And his contributions are more meaningful than ever. And I think that's evidenced by the generations of people that are currently up the stairs buying the books.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Not at all. Thank you. Okay.
Could you just first of all tell me your name and why you are here?
So I'm Rudy Lowe and I'm a visual artist, and a lot of my work is about theory and history, which kind of led me to Stuart Hall's work. So I've been a big fan of his work for a few years, and I really love the Stuart Hall Library as well, which he used to be the chair of. And yeah, I just, as soon as I heard about it, I knew that there would be a really great collection of books that would be specific to the kinds of things that I'm interested in that I work around.
And how did you first come to his work? Were you studying? Was it through a teacher? Can you remember the first time you heard about Stuart Hall?
It definitely wasn't through studying. I left art school and then kind of went on my own curriculum to find more black writers, which started off looking at the Black Panthers in the US and American black history, and then kind of looking more towards UK black history and black cultural theorists based here. I work part-time in a library as well, so I work a lot with young people in Tower Hamlets who are from marginalised backgrounds, you know, working class brown kids who don't necessarily have books at home, and their first point of access to reading is usually at school. So for me, it's very important to kind of find these texts, which I can then try to as well, you know, share that knowledge with younger people in my community. And so, yeah, there's just a really amazing collection of work here.
Yeah.
This one looks really good, which is A Different Reality, an account of black people's experiences and their grievances before and after the Handsworth Rebellions of September 1985. So, yeah, things like this that have first-hand accounts of people's experiences are always kind of treasures mm-hmm. to me. And for people coming who have, you know, different ideas of what they're looking for, there's such a wide range. It does feel like everybody could probably find something that they can relate to. There was one book which I didn't pick up, which I kind of regret now, which was also to do with Scotland. And, you know, things like this where, like, I don't necessarily know what Stuart Hall's tie to that specific issue was, but the fact that he could see how it related to all the other things as well, I think is really important. Having someone who can make those links together with different social issues and history and kind of weaving all that together is a very powerful thing to me.
Great, thank you. Thank you for your time.
In addition to his many books, Housmans also sold various journals, newspapers and magazines that Hall owned. One such political magazine was a 1988 copy of Marxism Today. I bought Hall's copy and took it with me when I went to interview the British journalist and writer Suzanne Moore at her home in North London.
Hi there. Suzanne, I've actually got a copy of Marxism Today.
It's been one for some years.
So this is the, it's from October 1988, and it's actually quite an important issue, a Marxism Today special on Britain in the 90s, which is coming out in 1988, so clearly it was trying to kind of predict what was likely to happen. And if I look inside here, there's a number of key theorists and people and politicians and journalists. There's an interview with David Blunkett, who would go on to become, when Labour came to power in 1997, the Education Secretary and then the Home Secretary. There's letters there from Ernesto Laclau, Beatrix Campbell's in here, the well-known writer, activist, journalist. And if I look down the editorial office, there is a Suzanne Moore down there, just underneath the editor, Martin Jakes. It sounds like it must have been an exciting time intellectually. I mean, given these ideas and debates and trying to take culture and consumption seriously.
Yeah, it was a really interesting time intellectually, and I miss it. And I miss it in the voice of Stuart, because it was a fantastic engagement with what was happening all the time, and also very challenging. We would have weekends and, you know, you'd have Eric Hobsbawm slugging it out with, you know, Stuart would be there and Will Hutton would be there, and I remember B. Campbell saying something about the need for a feminist analysis and Hobsbawm just absolutely dismissing it. Stuart didn't come till feminism till pretty late, I have to say. And in some ways, Stuart didn't come till race until quite late in his own work. You know, I mean, that's not me criticising it. It's just the development of his intellectual thought is interesting. You know, he ends up being such a huge person for any black intellectual, but he comes quite late to that, I think, because, you know, in his story, he came to England, didn't he, to an England he thought he knew, and then felt always slightly outside it, and then still, when he went back home, it wasn't home, and he felt outside, all of that stuff. He's very brilliant on that kind of dispossession, I think. But yeah, it was a really interesting time. It was a time when people really, really pushed each other to think. That's how I felt.
But what accounts for Hall coming to race late, as Moore puts it? Hall would have known from the very beginning of his Oxford University days that he was marked as different, an outsider, due to not being English, not being from the upper classes, and not being white. Someone as astute as Hall would have been keenly aware of the social distance between himself and many of his Oxford peers, and the fact that, even within those British New Left circles, he would frequently have been the only person of colour. It might be better to think of Hall's theorisation of race in his work and his own blackness as somewhat ambivalent and changing over time. In an interview with Les Back, Hall suggests that the space of autonomous black political organisation simply did not exist when he first came to England. The intellectual communities that he found himself in, the socialist consciousness that he inhabited, meant that questions of race became subsumed into questions about imperialism, and hence understood as a class problematic produced by capital that could be confronted by Marxism without the need for a separate race analysis.
You know, I was the only black person on the editorial board of New Left Review. Mm. The only black person. Mm. You know, my, you know, symbolic fathers, you know, Edward Thompson, yeah. Raymond Williams, Ralph Miliband, these are Peter Worsley, John Rex, you know. Mm. These were, you know, very experienced people. They were interested in imperialism. They were very anxious about imperialism. Mm. But they were not, they didn't understand that the black presence within Britain would be a transformatory presence, that it was going to expand, that it was part of the first tip of a wave which was going to follow in much expanded numbers after. In the seat was a change of conjunction.
Do you have a sense of...
Imagine what they... I know you can't imagine yourself to that time, but it really was like that. I mean, you know, it may have been that I could have been more articulate about it.
Hall is aware that in some ways he failed to push back against the theoretical frameworks of the leading figures of the New Left that ignored both black politics and race itself as a significant basis for struggle. But in some ways, it was a difficult burden of expectation for the young Hall to challenge and correct the racial amnesia of his mentors.
Were particular people at fault? Was I not sufficiently involved and committed? Couldn't I carry the argument with those people? Were they blind to it? All of those things are true.
Yeah.
From the late 1970s and throughout the rest of his career, Hall developed a more sustained and consistent focus on the cultural politics of race and the position of racism as a key source of social exclusion and inequality. It is his work from this time that made him an internationally influential scholar on the study of race, culture, identity, and diaspora. For some, Hall's standing as one of the leading black scholars of his generation is central to how we should understand his scholarship and legacy. When I spoke with Imani Perry, I asked her about the significance of framing Hall specifically as a black public intellectual.
I also wanted to ask, there was a recent article in The Nation magazine that profiled Stuart Hall's work and his life and his ideas. And it was interesting because in the article, there wasn't a single mention of the fact that Stuart Hall was a black intellectual. He's kind of... There's often mention made that he came from Jamaica and comes to the UK, and there's often a talk about his engagement with the New Left and certain types of socialist politics. But I'm wondering, you know, to what extent is it important to claim Stuart Hall as a black public intellectual and not just a public intellectual? What is kind of lost and gained in that moment? And I wonder if you could speak more specifically to the kind of the specificity and the importance of both Hall's work around race, but the kind of the model of being a black public intellectual that he offers.
Yes, I mean, I think it's incredibly important. And I think it's, you know, so that he was a Black intellectual and a Black public intellectual, and someone who spoke specifically to questions around race and racialization and racist discourses, and yet in no instance, you know, he didn't become limited to discussions of race. I don't want to speak about it. I'm uncomfortable about saying it in that way because I don't think discussing race is limited. But what I mean is that he understood race as part of a larger matrix and took space to speak about the larger matrix that went alongside race and racialization. But also, his biography was important. You know, his story, I think, is significant, not simply in terms of what it meant to be, you know, a young Black Jamaican man to come to the UK and experience the intensity of racialization in the UK, but also it was significant because he talked about sort of the ideology around empire that he learned from his mother, that he experienced that being challenged, you know, who identified with Great Britain, but that set of ideas is a challenge for him in his experience in the space. I think that's important too, because, you know, it speaks to the complexities of being a racialized subject and coming to a place not simply on the basis of the fact of your identity or ascription, but actually a reading of the world, right? An assessment of the landscape. I think that's an important model for an intellectual, because I don't like the idea that, and that often happens now in the sort of quote unquote Black public intellectual world, that you're expected to have a certain set of positions and that your value is that you present them as such, right? So you speak, you're a Black intellectual and you speak for Blackness in a set of ways. And I think he modeled a much, you know, really rich dynamic tapestry of what it about his subject position, but also his analysis of the world around him.
In 1979, Hall left Birmingham and the Centre for Contemporary Culture Studies and took up a position of Professor of Sociology at the Open University, where he would teach until his retirement in 1997. It is significant that Hall, who during the height of his fame in the 1980s and 1990s could have worked at any university in the world, made a conscious and in some ways political decision to instead work at the Open University. The OU, as it is popularly known in Britain, was established in 1969 by the then Labour government on the ideal of extending access to higher education to those typically excluded from Britain's rather elitist universities.
Hello and welcome to Open Forum. This is in fact the first of all the Open University television programmes. But here in the studio with me is the University Secretary, Mr. Christodoulou, and he's going to speak to you first. Chris.
Good morning and a very happy new year to all of you. I doubt that any university officer has ever had the opportunity of addressing 25,000 students of his own university and hundreds and thousands of the general public at one and the same time. And the fact that I have this opportunity today marks the fulfillment of one of the most exciting dreams of educationists and broadcasters.
Decades before massive open online courses became somewhat fashionable, the Open University provided a distance learning platform that created a vital educational space for working class and adult students across a variety of geographic locations. Using the BBC TV, Open University professors would record lectures that would air late at night. Eager students would use VHS players to record and later watch the shows. Stuart Hall himself thus became a familiar face on late-night British TV in the 1980s, discussing everything from the women's suffrage movement to the emergence of nationalism in Europe. Les Beck.
He was a brilliant teacher. You know, he spent a lot of his professional life at the Open University. You know, the Open University for US listeners, it's important to remember that's a university that's really taught via the television and via taped lectures. So it's distance learning. It's distance learning that is open to communities who can't afford the cost of full-time education. You know, it's part of that legacy of workers' education, you know, the collective highway.
Gary Young recalls the first time he was introduced to Stuart Hall.
The first time I became aware of him was on Open University, and I must have been 7 or 8 or something, and I remember seeing this bearded black man, black and white, you know, talking about things I had no comprehension of. That's the first time I'd ever seen him.
Remarkably, these taped lectures, some of which are decades old now, are still used in university classrooms. They serve as an archive of the brilliance with which Stuart Hall was able to make even the most complex ideas legible to a wide audience. The tens of thousands of students Hall was able to reach and teach during his time at the Open University was consistent with his broader political position, founded on empathy, inclusion, and social change through popular education.
I felt I was a good teacher. I loved my time at the Open University. When I left the centre, I wanted to go not to a place where, you know, I taught very bright students who'd already had many of the opportunities. I wanted to take those ideas into, you know, teaching people who had no formal educational background, etc. I love being a teacher. My life is a journey which many people have taken. It's a sort of paradigm of all those people who got on the Windrush and came to try and, you know, find another life.
That was Stuart Hall speaking on the BBC's Desert Island Discs. On February the 10th, 2014, Stuart Hall passed away. He was 82 years old. Henry Louis Gates, the renowned Harvard professor of African American Studies, referred to Hall at the time as the W.E.B. Du Bois of Britain. It was a remarkable epitaph for a man who had made an improbable journey from his birthplace in colonial Kingston, Jamaica, to what became his home in London, England. Although Hall's death marked an end to his life and brought sadness to those who knew him and his work, it would be a mistake to think of this moment as the final chapter of the Hall story. Even in the few short years since his death, there has already been a renewed interest in his life and ideas. Duke University Press announced a major new book series entitled Stuart Hall Selected Writings, with the aim of publishing all of Hall's key writings. Oxford University created a new doctoral scholarship in memory of Hall, and the Stuart Hall Foundation in London continues to support new generations of writers, thinkers and artists. But beyond these important institutions and new publications dedicated to Hall, his legacy lives on through the thousands of students he taught and whose lives he changed, as well as the countless academics who continue to draw upon Hall's ideas in their work. Hall's point that political leaders use populist, anti-immigrant and racially charged rhetoric in order to mobilise nationalist sentiments to pursue authoritarian policies is surely as relevant today as it was in the 1970s. It is perhaps in Hall's writings that we may find answers to today's urgent political questions, or at least find the guiding principles for the types of questions we should be asking in this conjuncture. If we are truly interested in understanding the current political moment in order to better analyse its complexity, with an eye to then changing those conditions for the better, then we need to remain in conversation with Hall, to read, listen, talk back, and engage him. You've been listening to Stuart Hall in Conversations, produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas, by Maggie Tate and Rebecca McEnroy. With special thanks to Anima Ajipong, Ariana Garcia, Hulk Mendenhall, and Todd Callahan. Thanks also to Houseman's Bookstore, the Wolford Centre for African and African American Studies, and Cherie Smith. You can listen back to the show, along with podcasts of all of my extended interviews, by subscribing to Stuart Hall in Conversations in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ben Carrington. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.